game. Perhaps the biggest problem was that Destiny still didn't have much in the way of an identity among Bungie's staff. If you were to go to Bungie and ask people what they thought Destiny was, said one former employee, half the studio would probably say it's a Halo shooter and the other half would say it's World of Warcraft. The studio was growing rapidly, which made communication even more difficult. By 2013, there were hundreds of people working on Destiny in Bungie's unreasonably dark Bellevue offices. Not everyone played the game every day, and few of them could visualize what Destiny would ultimately look like, which led to, as a different former employee described it, a bunch of great ideas that are all siloed off, and none of them actually complementing each other. Journalists had left the February event wondering exactly how Destiny would work. At Bungie, people were asking the same question. In game development, one of the most important pairs of buzzwords is also the one you're most likely to see on a hacky marketing resume: unified direction. In other words, everyone needs to be on the same page. Because video games have so many granular moving pieces, sounds, user interface, visual effects, and so on, every department needs to have a strong, consistent idea of where a game is headed. The larger a team gets, the more important this concept becomes. As with many video games, Destiny had pillars, mostly generic ideas like a world players want to be in and a bunch of fun things to do. But people who worked on the game said they found it difficult to visualize the final product for several reasons. The company grew faster than the management structure and leadership process, said one person who worked on the game, which left many departments mismanaged with no clear understanding of the game's high-level vision. It was like they were 15th-century explorers leaving Europe. They knew how to steer a ship, and they knew they wanted to go west. They just didn't know where they were going to wind up. Destiny's staff knew they were making a shooter, one that looked great, felt fantastic to play, and would let you team up with friends and strangers. But other areas of the game remained ambiguous, especially Joe Staten's story. The project had gotten bigger than some at Bungie had ever imagined. The first Halo, which had been the work of around 50 people, felt like a lifetime ago. By mid-2013, Destiny was being developed by hundreds of staff. When you played the Halo games, you really felt people's fingerprints on it. You could look at it and know a human made this project, said one former Bungie employee. Because we had ballooned to such a large size, that just wasn't part of the program anymore. Another major challenge was that Bungie had decided to rebuild its internal engine alongside Destiny, which was a whole lot of fun for the engineers, but made life far more difficult for everyone else. As the Dragon Age Inquisition team learned the hard way, building a new engine alongside a game is always a recipe for extra work. Although Bungie's engineering team had devised impressive, cutting-edge technology to support Destiny's matchmaking and other behind-the-scenes functions, the development tools that Bungie used to make the game were subpar, according to people who worked with them. Whereas on Halo it might have taken 10 to 15 seconds for a design change to show up in the game, on Destiny it could take upward of half an hour. Our content iteration times are pretty bad, Bungie's engineering director Chris Butcher admitted during a talk at the Game Developers Conference in 2015. You can be looking at minutes for small changes and tens of minutes for big changes. What that meant was that for Bungie's artists and designers, basic tasks took way longer than expected, and the inefficiencies added up. The biggest differentiator between a studio that creates a really high-quality game and a studio that doesn't isn't the quality of the team, said one person who worked on Destiny. It's their dev tools. If you can take 50 shots on goal and you're a pretty shitty hockey player, and I can only take 3 shots on goal and I'm Wayne fucking Gretzky, you're probably going to do better. That's what tools are. It's how fast can you iterate? How stable are they? How robust are they? How easy is it as a non-technical artist to move a thing? Anyone who's ever screamed at a sluggish piece of computer software knows how frustrating it can be to have slow tools, whether it's Microsoft Word or a graphics renderer. It's the least sexy part of development, yet it's the single most important factor there ever is, said the person. Good tools equals better game, always. A third problem, on top of the incohesive vision and inefficient tools, was Bungie's increasingly tense relationship with Activision. There's always some level of tension between a game developer and its publisher. Creative people and money people make for uncomfortable bedfellows. But with Destiny, the stakes were enormous. It was the biggest gamble Activision had ever made, which was why some of the publisher's executives had gotten jittery when Bungie's first playable build turned out to be subpar. They delivered a level that was playable, but not to the standard we talked about, said one person who worked for Activision. It was, that person said, repetitive and not very fun. So even as they hyped up Destiny to fans and journalists, Bungie was struggling. The size of the team had become unwieldy, the vision for the game was unclear, and the engine was a mess. Everyone knew something was going to give. They just didn't know when. Marty O'Donnell likes to say he saw the meltdown coming. It was the summer of 2013, and the longtime Bungie audio director had just become entangled in a public feud with Activision over a Destiny trailer they'd published during E3. Much to O'Donnell's dismay, Activision had scored the trailer with its own booming music rather than the epic, sweeping choral suite that O'Donnell had composed for Destiny with his partner Michael Salvatore and the former Beatle Paul McCartney. Fuming about what he referred to internally as a counterfeit trailer, O'Donnell sent out a series of tweets on E3's first day. June 11th, 2013, 12:33 a.m. I'm so proud of everything the Bungie team has created and produced. The trailer was made by Activision Marketing, not Bungie. June 11th, 2013, 9:02 p.m. To be clear, the official Destiny E3 gameplay trailer, 2 minutes 47 seconds, was not made by @Bungie. It was made by the company that brought you COD. That'd be Call of Duty, Activision's popular series of military shooter games. June 11th, 2013, 9:05 p.m. @Bungie made the rest of all the other Destiny stuff at E3. Activision's executives were infuriated at the breach of protocol. In the NDA-heavy video game industry, there's an understanding that creative conflict should be handled privately, not on Twitter. Almost immediately, Activision CEO Eric Hirschberg emailed Bungie CEO Harold Ryan, imploring him to please put a stop to this as soon as possible before more damage is done. O'Donnell, who at 58 was one of Bungie's oldest employees, now found himself at odds with people who had been his co-workers for over a decade. Drama aside, Bungie had bigger problems than trailers and tweets. For the past few years, much of the Destiny team had wondered what the game's story would ultimately look like. They'd heard bits and pieces, sure. They'd recorded dialogue, directed cutscenes, and created character models based on the partial scripts that Joe Staten and his team were delivering. But few people at Bungie outside of Jason Jones and the writers had seen the entire story, and many at the studio, including Marty O'Donnell, were stressing about the fact that it wasn't finished yet. Plus, there was that lingering question, how would Destiny have both a grand epic story and the personal legends that Bungie had been touting? Back in the Halo days, O'Donnell would spend a lot of time talking about game stories with Staten and Jones. As audio director, O'Donnell was responsible not just for composing music, but for directing and recording all the voice acting, so it was helpful for him to have an early grasp on what the overall plot would look like. On Destiny, things were different. Maybe it was the size of the studio, or the fact that Jason Jones was being pulled in multiple simultaneous directions and didn't have enough time to give the story his undivided attention. Whatever it was, O'Donnell wasn't happy. Every time I worked with Joe Staten, I said, Joe, I'm really out in the dark here on where the story's going. I don't understand what's happening with the story, O'Donnell said. And he would say that he was frustrated too. And at least what he told me was that he was frustrated with the lack of commitment from Jason. Jason would say, yes, this is good. Then a month later say, no, we shouldn't do this. So there was a lot of what looked like indecision coming from Jason. In the summer of 2013, months after Jones and Staten had hyped up the story of Destiny to press and weeks after O'Donnell had feuded with Activision, O'Donnell went to the hospital to get sinus surgery. Just a few days after he got home, catastrophe began. I got a sort of panicked email from Bungie's production director, Jonty Barnes, saying, oh my gosh, Joe released this supercut thing, and everybody's up in arms and worried about the story, O'Donnell said. And I was lying on the couch in a drug haze from recovering, and I was just sort of like, you've got to be kidding me. This is horrible. Said supercut thing, or as it was more commonly called, the supercut, was a 2-hour internal video that was meant to convey Destiny's entire story. To most observers, it was a mess. Staten had compiled and edited the supercut almost entirely on his own, peppering it with incomplete dialogue, half-finished voice acting, and rough animation. People at Bungie, many of whom were already nervous about the state of the game's story, found it impossible to understand. In the Supercut's version of Destiny's story, the player's main goal was to hunt down an artificially intelligent war machine named Rasputin, who had been kidnapped by the swarming undead alien Hive. On the journey, the player would head to Earth, Venus, Mars, the Moon, Saturn, and a mystical temple on Mercury, where an Obi-Wan Kenobi-like wizard named Osiris would offer advice and words of wisdom. Along the way, the player would befriend and team up with characters like The Crow, a suave alien with pale blue skin and slick hair. Opinions varied on this story's quality, but almost everyone outside the writer's room agreed that the supercut itself was a disaster. Joe's vision probably made tons of sense in his own mind, said Marty O'Donnell. And Joe was just thinking, come on, everybody. We've all got to go in the same direction. We've got to start now. Here it is. This isn't perfect, but we can fix it. Instead, it backfired completely. Just about everybody in the studio thought, oh my gosh, this is a train wreck. Perhaps by putting out the supercut, Joe Staten had hoped to force the studio's hand. Maybe he wanted to make Jason Jones and the rest of Bungie's leadership commit to a singular vision for Destiny's story and stick to it. One former Bungie employee said Jones had actually requested that Staten make a presentation so they could all assess the state of the story. Staten declined to be interviewed for this book. Few people at Bungie anticipated what would happen next. Shortly after the supercut circulated, Jason Jones gave the studio a new edict. They needed to reboot the story. It was time to start over. Staten's story was too linear, Jones said, and too similar to Halo. Starting now, Jones told the studio, they were going to rewrite Destiny's story from scratch. Joe Staten, Marty O'Donnell, and others at Bungie pushed back, telling Jones that there was no feasible way to reboot the story this late in production. They'd already delayed Destiny once, bumping the game from fall 2013 to spring 2014, and this past year had already been terrible for their relationship with Activision. Overhauling the story now, less than a year before the game was supposed to come out, would either lead to a delay, a mediocre story, or both. Bungie had vowed that Destiny's story could live up to Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. Suddenly they were going to throw it all away and start over? Yes, Jones told his team, this wasn't up for debate. They were rebooting the story. Over the following months, Jones put together a small group of people that he called Iron Bar. In this group were some of the lieutenants whom Jones trusted most, like the art director Chris Barrett and the designer Luke Smith, a former journalist who had started at Bungie as a community manager in 2007, then rose meteorically to the top of the company. Not coincidentally, both Chris Barrett and Luke Smith went on to become the creative directors of future Destiny DLC and sequels. Also on board was Eric Robb, a longtime book editor whom Bungie had hired to help come up with Destiny's lore. Every day for several weeks, Jones held extensive meetings with this Iron Bar group, trying to figure out a new outline for Destiny. Then Jones took those ideas to a larger group of leads, which he called Blacksmith, to get feedback. Bungie always had a flair for dramatic nomenclature. The Blacksmith was meant to hammer the Iron Bar. Outside of Robb, few of Bungie's writers were involved in this process. As one former employee put it, the writing team Joe put together was ostracized. The story was written without writers. To some people at Bungie, this felt like a necessary Hail Mary, the type of last-minute drastic play that was oh so common in game development just as a project was nearing completion. To others, including Joe Staten, it felt like suicide. Joe made a big push for sanity and rationality, said one former Bungie employee. He basically said, people, the supercut can be saved, but if we try to recreate the game in 6 months, it's going to make a lot of people miserable. Staten's efforts failed, though, and by the end of the summer, he was gone. On September 24th, 2013, Staten announced the news on Bungie's website with a gracious note. After 15 great years at Bungie, from the battlefields of Myth to the mysteries of Halo and beyond, I'm leaving to tackle new creative challenges. While this may come as a surprise, fear not. It's been my pleasure building Destiny these past 4 years, and after the big reveal this summer, our hugely talented team is on track for greatness. I'll be cheering all of them, with all of you, when the game launches next year. Thank you for your support of me and your continued support of Bungie. We couldn't have done it without you. Marty O'Donnell also saw the writing, or the lack of writing, on the wall. I saw that was the decision Jason Jones made, that's what he was proposing, and I said, okay, well, good luck with that. Because you already know I completely believe that's impossible, and it's going to cause a death march, and it's not going to cause quality to happen, said O'Donnell. Jason still wanted me to be part of Blacksmith, and I said, I think that's a mistake. I'm not on board with you on this. I don't believe in this plan. O'Donnell, who found the whole process miserable, wound up the naysayer in the room, as he recalled it, shooting down many of the ideas that Jones and crew brought to the table. But he continued attending Blacksmith meetings nonetheless. In the late summer of 2013, as gamers across the world eagerly waited for Destiny, Bungie's top developers spent marathon sessions locked in conference rooms, trying to piece together a new story. First, they reduced the scope of the game, cutting out chunks like Mercury and Saturn, which they'd later use in downloadable content, and centering Destiny on four planets, Earth, the Moon, Venus, and Mars. Sure, the moon isn't technically a planet, but in the parlance of Destiny, the two are interchangeable. Rather than have players visit all four of those planets within the first few missions of the game, as had been laid out in the supercut, Bungie decided to treat each planet as a separate act, ramping up the difficulty as players progressed from area to area. On the moon, you'd meet the Swarming Hive. On Venus, the ancient mechanical Vex. In the deserts of Mars, you'd have to defeat hordes of militaristic Cabal. Next, the Iron Bar and Blacksmith groups ripped into each mission of the game that Bungie had already created, splicing together old ideas and encounters to form the Chimera that was Destiny's new campaign. One old mission might get a brand new premise. Another might be split into three chunks and spread throughout three new missions. It was like tearing up a quilt, then stitching back together all the old squares in a new pattern, no matter how improperly they fit. Said one person who worked on the game, "If you were going from point A to point Z in the course of the original pre-reboot story, they would take out section H through J because it was really tight encounter design, and they'd put it off to the side and say, 'How do we get H to J in this other storyline?'" It was literally like making Frankenstory, that person said. At the end of the Iron Bar meetings, Destiny had a new story, one that, coincidentally, seemed as if it had been crafted by a committee of designers and producers. There were none of the personal legends that Bungie had promised. The plot of each mission would vacillate between vague and incoherent, strung together by meaningless proper nouns and baffling dialogue. One line, unconvincingly uttered by a robot called the Stranger, a rebooted version of a character from Staten's version of the story, summed up the plot rather definitively. "I don't have time to explain why I don't have time to explain." Nowhere was Destiny's rocky development more apparent than in the work of Peter Dinklage, the Emmy Award-winning actor best known for his role as the savvy dwarf Tyrion Lannister on Game of Thrones. In Destiny, Dinklage voiced Ghost, a pocket-sized robot who served as a player's narrator and constant companion. Joe Staten and his team had planned for Ghost to supplement a large cast of characters who would talk to you during each mission. As you played, Ghost would interact with the environment and comment on your actions. But after the Iron Bar reboot, Ghost became Destiny's main star, responsible for delivering the bulk of the game's dialogue, a role that Dinklage hadn't signed on for. He was not supposed to be the exposition guy, and he certainly was never supposed to be the only voice you heard while you played the game, said Marty O'Donnell. Bungie had dished out big money for other celebrity voice actors like Bill Nye, Nathan Fillion, and Gina Torres, but the story reboot had overhauled and minimized all those characters, leaving Dinklage and Ghost to shoulder the load. As O'Donnell worked with the actors to record dialogue throughout the rest of 2013 and then 2014, the scripts kept changing. The studio was rewriting them constantly, sometimes up until the very last minute. Bungie had persuaded Activision to let them delay Destiny again, this time to September 2014, but the process hadn't gotten any more efficient. "I wouldn't have a script until just before walking into the session, so I didn't even know what it was," said O'Donnell. "Instead of having 300 lines of dialogue to do in 4 hours, I was given 1,000. I'm like, okay, this is just going to be like reading the phone book. This is bad, but I'll get it done. It could sound like I was sabotaging, but I wasn't. I really was trying to make everything as good as I possibly could, but my spidey sense was telling me that this wasn't good. The story wasn't there. The characters weren't there." Combine an overworked voice actor with a disgruntled audio director, and you have the formula for atrocious performances, particularly when Destiny's dialogue included lines like, "The sword is close. I can feel its power. Careful. Its power is dark." In April 2014, Bungie fired Marty O'Donnell, a move that felt both shocking and inevitable. In the months to come, O'Donnell filed lawsuits against Bungie for failing to pay his wages and for confiscating his stock. An arbitrator ruled in O'Donnell's favor, giving him a nice payday. One of his first reactions, of course, was to tweet about it. April 16, 2014, 1:28 a.m. "I'm saddened to say that Bungie's board of directors terminated me without cause on April 11, 2014. It was the end of an era, both for O'Donnell and for the company he'd helped build. Like many video game publishers, Activision tended to stick review score bonuses into contracts, offering extra payouts to developers whose games hit a certain threshold on video game aggregation sites like Metacritic or Game Rankings. Destiny was no exception. Thanks to an early version of the Destiny contract that had leaked in 2012, it became public knowledge that Bungie would get a $2.5 million bonus if Destiny's aggregated review score hit 90 or above. In the weeks leading up to the launch, Bungie's employees would hang out in the kitchen and take guesses at Destiny's Metacritic score. Some suggested they'd get a 90 or 95. Other, more conservative staffers thought it might wind up in the high 80s, just below their bonus target. Their five Halo games had an average score of 92 on Metacritic, so they had good reason to be optimistic. Destiny came out on September 9th, 2014. A week later, once most of the reviews had hit, the Metacritic score landed at 77. Needless to say, Bungie missed its bonus. Reviews called out Destiny's frustrating grinding mechanics and its repetitive mission structure. Critics slammed the stingy loot drop rates, the tedious endgame, and the lack of explanation for basic features. And most of all, people panned the story. The characters didn't make sense, key plot points were left unexplained, and the dialogue was hilariously clunky. Peter Dinklage's flat voice acting became the subject of memes and jokes across the internet. One line, "That wizard came from the moon," had been so widely mocked during Destiny's public alpha test that Bungie removed it from the game. But the rest of the script wasn't much better. What was particularly frustrating was that Destiny's lore was full of chewy, delicious sci-fi morsels. Many of the game's characters and weapons had compelling, intricate backstories. They were just hidden behind what Destiny called grimoire cards, short stories penned by Staten's old writing team that were accessible only on Bungie's website. Destiny established tons of promising concepts, like the Black Garden, an area on Mars that had been locked out of time by the robotic Vex, but never quite delivered on their potential. Pete Parson's old quote became a running joke. Destiny, sitting in the pantheon of great stories alongside Star Wars and Lord of the Rings? It could barely sit next to Twilight. Morale at Bungie sunk. During a series of emergency meetings, the studio's leadership decided to overhaul their plans for the near future. In addition to fixing some of the biggest mechanical problems with free patches, they rebooted both of their planned downloadable content packs, The Dark Below and House of Wolves, remaking the missions and stripping out all the Peter Dinklage lines they'd already recorded. One of the most inexplicable early Destiny decisions revolved around engrams, the decahedral treasure chests that players could pop open for new loot. In the endgame, the only worthwhile gear was the rarest legendary caliber weapons and armor, which were purple. You'd get a little rush of endorphins whenever you discovered a purple engram that might lead to a legendary piece of gear. But nearly 50% of the time, cracking open a purple engram would give you an inferior blue piece of loot. A bizarre decision that did nothing but infuriate players until it was changed in October 2014. Destiny, they decided, was done with Dinklage. In the coming months, Bungie's designers would devour feedback on forums like Reddit, trying to implement as many short and long-term fixes as they could. In both The Dark Below and House of Wolves, they experimented with new types of missions and leveling systems that players enjoyed far more. At the end of 2014, a group of Blizzard leads, including Josh Mascara, the director of Diablo III Reaper of Souls, flew up to Bungie's offices for a pep rally. The parallels between Diablo III and Destiny were uncanny. Not only were both games published by Activision, they'd both launched with similar issues: a frustrating loot system, a punishing endgame, and way too much focus on random numbers. In a presentation to Bungie's staff, Mascara explained how they'd fixed Diablo III's problems, telling the story of how they transformed their game over two painful years, from Era 37 to Reaper of Souls. "It was like present us talking to past us," said Mascara. "They were afraid of all the same things that we were afraid of. It was just amazing to be able to go up there and talk to them, and they got to see, well, okay, all the things you guys did in Reaper were sort of moving in that direction. You guys are on the other side of the wall now. So there's life on the other side." Bungie's staff said they found Mascara's talk invaluable. Despite Destiny's many early stumbles, and despite Bungie regularly losing veterans who had been there since the Halo days, there was a belief that they had made something fundamentally solid. Despite everything, millions of people were playing Destiny. Most of them were complaining about Destiny as they played, but the game was addictive enough to keep them entertained nonetheless. The game's most important elements, the setting, the art direction, the way it felt to shoot guns, were all as stellar as you'd expect from the studio that had made Halo. If Bungie could fix some of the other problems, then maybe, just like Blizzard, they too could find redemption. It'd have to start with Destiny's first big expansion, the game codenamed Comet that had been laid out in their contract. With this expansion, Bungie had originally planned to introduce a new planet, Europa, and several new zones across Earth and Mars. But production issues again forced them to cut down their scope. When they'd finalized plans for the expansion, which they called the Taken King, they knew it would center on a single location, the Dreadnought, an infested hive ship floating near the rings of Saturn. Bungie also overhauled the leveling and loot systems, incorporating a great deal of fans' feedback to make Destiny feel more player-friendly. It helped that the director of The Taken King, Luke Smith, was an obsessive Destiny player who had racked up hundreds of hours in the game. Bungie also knew that if it was going to win back fans and critics, The Taken King needed a decent story. Under the writer Clay Carmouche, Bungie took a new narrative approach for The Taken King, one that felt far more focused. There was a clear villain, Oryx, the ruler of a phantasmagoric group of aliens called The Taken, and the game would give players ample motivation to track him down and kill him. Irritating characters like the Stranger disappeared for good, while the more charming members of Destiny's cast, like Nathan Fillion's snarky Cade 6, took on more prevalent roles. Carmouche left the studio not long after shipping The Taken King. Bungie also made the remarkable, unprecedented move of wiping Destiny's main star from the game. To play Ghost in The Taken King, they hired the energetic voice actor Nolan North, who lent his voice not just to new dialogue, but to re-recordings of every single line in the original version of Destiny. Even Marlon Brando couldn't have done much with a line like, "Careful, its power is dark," but by replacing the monotonous work of Peter Dinklage, Bungie was signaling to the world that it wanted to get things right this time. Fans were pleased with Nolan North, but years later, there are those who miss the so-called Dinklebot and wish they could hear his dreary voice in Destiny again. When The Taken King launched on September 15, 2015, it was universally lauded. Wrote my good friend and Destiny companion Kirk Hamilton on Kotaku, "After a year of missteps and half-recoveries, Bungie has found their firmest footing since last September. The Taken King's creators have looked their players in the eye and confidently laid down a convincing vision of what Destiny has and will continue to become." It would have been nice indeed if the story behind Destiny had ended there, if Bungie, like Blizzard, had fixed its mistakes then moved on to the next big thing. Even as they launched The Taken King, however, Bungie's leadership knew the road ahead would be rocky. Their ambitious 10-year contract with Activision stipulated that they'd have to release a sequel, Destiny 2, in the fall of 2016. That wasn't going to happen. Expectations were too high, plans were shifting too frequently, and their tools were too slow. In January 2016, Bungie delayed Destiny 2 another year, again renegotiating their contract with Activision to buy the team more time. To replace Destiny 2, they put together a moderate-sized expansion pack called Rise of Iron that they'd release in September 2016. Days later, Bungie fired its CEO, Harold Ryan, and throughout the year, dissatisfied veterans continued to leave the company, battling with Bungie's board of directors over office politics and a bizarrely long stock vesting schedule. At most tech companies, it'd take 3 or 4 years for an employee's stock to vest and fully belong to him or her. At Bungie, where the stock vesting schedule was tied to Destiny releases, it might take nearly a decade. To some of those departed Bungie veterans, who had cheered so loudly back in 2007 when the studio announced that it was spinning out from Microsoft, going independent had been the company's biggest mistake. 10 years later, how many of the people who had signed Bungie's ostentatious Declaration of Independence were even left at the studio? When we were working with Microsoft, Bungie was like this little punk rock band who always shook their tiny little skinny fist at mom and dad, said one former employee. And when we spun out, we didn't have anyone to shake our tiny fists at. We actually had to self-govern and run ourselves. As I write this chapter in early 2017, the story of Destiny is still ongoing. There are lingering questions, both within and outside Bungie, about the future of the franchise. How will people react to Destiny 2? What will happen to the series after that? Will Bungie remain independent, or will Activision find a way to buy it? By the time this book is published, some of those questions will be answered. Others might take a little longer. I think the real story of Destiny's development is that just making any game is incredibly hard, said Jamie Griesmer. Trying to make an ambitious game under a lot of pressure is staggeringly hard. When you have just quantic explosions and craterings and huge assimilation and communication problems on a team, you end up wasting so many resources and so much time that you see it in the final game. All things considered, it's remarkable that Bungie found a way to ship anything, let alone build something as popular as Destiny, a video game in which players travel through space, complaining about Destiny. Maybe the studio didn't quite make Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, and maybe they lost some of their soul and a lot of talented employees along the way. But Destiny's challenges were many of the same challenges that nearly every video game production has faced over the years. The stakes were just higher. And the story of Destiny, more specifically the story around Destiny, turned out to be fascinating for reasons Bungie could never have planned. Chapter 9. The Witcher 3. Marcin Iwiński grew up under the specter of Stalinism, which made it tough to play a lot of computer games. With light blue eyes and a face that seemed to be in a constant state of stubble, Iwiński was one of many teenagers in Warsaw, Poland, who wished he could just play the same games as everyone else in the world. Until 1989, Poland was a communist country, and even in the early 1990s, as the newly democratic Third Polish Republic began embracing the free market, there was nowhere in Warsaw to buy games legally. There were, however, computer markets, open-air bazaars where the city's geeks would unite to buy, sell, and trade pirated software. Polish copyright laws were essentially non-existent, so there was nothing illegal about ripping a foreign computer game to a floppy disk, then selling it for cheap at the market. Marcin Iwiński and his high school friend Michal Kaczynski would spend all their spare time at the markets, bringing home whatever they could find to play on their old ZX Spectrum computers. In 1994, when he was 20, Iwiński started envisioning a business that would import and distribute computer games throughout the country. He and Kaczynski teamed up to start a company called CD Projekt, named after the industry-changing CD-ROMs that had just popped up in Warsaw. At first, they imported and traded games to the computer market, then they started signing deals with outside companies like LucasArts and Blizzard to distribute those companies' games in Poland. CD Projekt's big break arrived when they convinced the publisher Interplay to give them the Polish rights to Baldur's Gate, one of the most popular role-playing games in the world. That Baldur's Gate was developed by BioWare, Dragon Age Inquisition, localized by CD Projekt, The Witcher 3, and emulated by Obsidian, Pillars of Eternity, is testament either to the immense influence of that game or to the fact that I really like RPGs and wanted to cover three of them in this book. Knowing it'd be difficult to persuade their Polish brethren to buy proper copies of the game rather than pirating it online or at the market, Iwiński and Kaczynski went all out. In addition to localizing Baldur's Gate in Polish, complete with authentic Polish voice acting, they stuffed the game's box with a map, a Dungeons & Dragons guide, and a CD soundtrack, gambling that Polish players would see the package's value as a justification to buy Baldur's Gate instead of pirating it. If you got a ripped version of the game, you wouldn't get all those goodies. The tactic worked. On day one, CD Projekt sold 18,000 copies, a massive number for a country where, just a few years earlier, buying games legally hadn't even been an option. It opened the door for Iwiński and his company to publish all the other big RPGs that were popping up, like Planescape Torment, Icewind Dale, and Fallout. This success in the distribution market allowed Iwiński to start pursuing his real dream, to make his own video games. And by 2002, he'd launched CD Projekt Red, a development branch of CD Projekt. The question was, what kind of game was this new studio going to make? Someone at the company suggested that they start up a conversation with Andrzej Sapkowski, the renowned fantasy writer who is generally considered to be the Polish version of J.R.R. Tolkien. Sapkowski had written a series of popular books called The Witcher, a favorite of both adults and children throughout Poland. Starring a white-haired monster hunter named Geralt of Rivia, The Witcher mixed gritty fantasy with Eastern European fairy tales, like a cross between Game of Thrones and the Brothers Grimm. Turned out Sapkowski had no interest in video games, and he was happy to sell the rights to CD Projekt Red for a reasonable price. Iwiński and crew knew very little about developing games, but with The Witcher, they had an established property, which would be far easier than starting from scratch. It was also an appealing property, one that they thought might draw broad interest not just in Poland, but across the world. In 2007, after a tough 5-year development cycle and multiple reboots, CD Projekt Red released The Witcher for personal computers. The game sold well enough to justify a sequel, and in 2011, CD Projekt put out The Witcher 2. Both games shared several traits. They were both dark, gritty action RPGs. They both tried to make the player feel like he or she was making consequential decisions that had an impact on how the story would unfold. And they were both challenging, esoteric PC games. Although CD Projekt Red would later port The Witcher 2 to the Xbox 360, both games were generally seen as PC-centric, which meant their audience was limited. Competing games like The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, November 2011, sold millions and millions in part because they were simultaneously released on both PC and consoles. Also, Skyrim was North American. By the mid-2000s, as the gaming industry became more globalized, role-playing games had formed their own sort of geographical divide. In the United States and Canada, you'd find companies like Bethesda and BioWare, with big, critically acclaimed hits like The Elder Scrolls and Mass Effect, both of which sold gangbusters. Out of Japan came Square Enix's Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, which weren't quite as trendy as they had been during the Japan-dominated 1990s, but still held their own among millions of fans. And then there were the European RPG publishers, which never drew as much respect as their American or Japanese counterparts. European RPGs like Two Worlds and Venetica were generic, janky, and critically panned. With The Witcher 2, Iwiński and his studio had built a sizable audience outside Europe, and even become a cultural icon in Poland, to the point where in 2011, when U.S. President Barack Obama visited the country, Prime Minister Donald Tusk gifted him a copy of The Witcher 2. Obama later admitted that he had not played it. But the developers at CD Projekt Red were dreaming bigger. They wanted to prove that, even though they were Polish, they could compete with the Bethesdas and Square Enixes of the world. Iwiński wanted CD Projekt Red to be as much of a household name as BioWare, and he wanted that to happen with The Witcher 3. To lead this third Witcher game, Iwiński and the other executives tapped Konrad Tomaszkiewicz, who had been a tester on the first Witcher before leaping up to become head of CD Projekt Red's Quest department, which they'd created during early development of The Witcher 2. Traditionally, an RPG studio would have separate writing and design departments, which collaborated to build all of a game's quests. Kill 10 dragons, defeat the Dark Lord, and save the princess. At CD Projekt Red, however, the quest department was its own entity, with a team of people who were each responsible for designing, implementing, and improving their own chunks of the game. As head of this department, Tomaszkiewicz had spent a lot of time collaborating with the other teams, which made him a good fit to be the director of The Witcher 3. When he was told he'd be in charge of their next big game, an anxious Tomaszkiewicz started talking to CD Projekt Red's other executives about how they'd make the game appealing to as many people as possible. One of their immediate solutions was simple. Make it huge. We spoke with studio head Adam Badowski and the board, and we asked them what was missing in our games to make them more perfect RPGs, Tomaszkiewicz said. And we knew we missed the freedom of exploration, and we needed a bigger world. Konrad Tomaszkiewicz fantasized about a Witcher 3 that wouldn't restrict you to one specific area per chapter, the way previous games had. Instead, this new Witcher game would let you explore a big open world, hunting monsters and undertaking quests at your discretion. Freedom was the word Iwiński used most often as a pillar for what the game would offer. They wanted it to be the best-looking game you could buy, and this time they would do a simultaneous release on both consoles and PCs. With The Witcher 3, CD Projekt Red wanted to show the world that Poland could make games just as critically and commercially successful as its competitors. Right away, Tomaszkiewicz and his team established some basic ideas. They knew they wanted to tell a story about the hero Geralt hunting for his adopted daughter, Ciri, popular character from the Witcher books who could wield powerful magic. They knew that the primary villain would be a group called the Wild Hunt, a phalanx of spectral horsemen based on the European folk myth of the same name. They knew they wanted The Witcher 3 to take place in three massive regions, Skellige, a group of Nordic-inspired islands, Novigrad, the largest and richest city in Witcher lore, and Velen, also known as No Man's Land, a poor, war-ravaged swampland. We were terrified of the scope, said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. But at this company, we all wanted to create the best experience of games out there. And we are driven by challenges, even a huge challenge which is almost impossible to do. As they entered pre-production, the design team started discussing and plotting out structural ideas, which were already getting complicated. There were a lot of actually challenging bits in terms of paper design, said the lead quest designer, Mateusz Tomaszkiewicz, Konrad's younger brother. For example, the original idea was that once you leave the prologue, you were supposed to be able to go to one of the three regions, any of them. The goal of this decision was to allow for more freedom, Iwiński's watchword, but it left the designers in a tough spot. CD Projekt Red had already decided that The Witcher 3's enemies would have predetermined levels rather than scaling up with the player. Level scaling, most famously used in The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, had been detested by RPG players, who'd complained that when enemies leveled up with you, it eliminated the feeling that your character was making real progress. Few video game experiences were less pleasant than watching your high-level superhero get slaughtered by a gang of pitiful goblins. Without level scaling, however, there was no way to balance the difficulty in an open-world RPG. If the player could choose to go to Skellige, Novigrad, or Velen at the start of the game, all three of those regions would have to be populated with low-level enemies, or else they'd be too tough. But if all three regions had low-level enemies, you'd be able to breeze through them all once you'd gain some experience. To solve this problem, CD Projekt Red went with a more linear structure. After the prologue, you'd go to Velen, low level, then Novigrad, mid level, then Skellige, high level. You'd still have the freedom to move between regions, but progression would be a little more restricted. Besides, if the game was going to be as big as they hoped, they would need to funnel players a little bit. We wanted you to feel like you're not lost, and basically you know more or less where to go and what the structure is, said Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz. When you are free to go anywhere, we felt that after the prologue, it was too much at once, that you would be overwhelmed. Early on, the developers knew that they wanted The Witcher 3 to be far larger than anything else out there. Most video games aimed for a campaign that was between 10 and 20 hours long. The bigger ones, the RPGs and open-world games, usually set out for a range of 40 to 60. With The Witcher 3, CD Projekt Red wanted a game that would take at least 100 hours to finish. To hit a number that absurd, The Witcher 3's designers needed to start as early as possible, sketching and writing as much as they could during pre-production, before there was even a game to play. Everything would begin in the writer's room. We start with a very general idea, said Jakub Szamałek, one of the writers. Then we expand it, then we cut it into quests, then we work closely with quest designers to make sure it all makes sense from their perspective, and then we iterate, and iterate, and iterate. The main quest would center on Geralt's hunt for Ciri, they decided, with interludes throughout the game in which you'd play as Geralt's adopted daughter. There would also be a series of important quest lines that were optional, but would have a major impact on the game's ending, like a potential regicide plot and a love triangle between Geralt and the sorceresses Triss and Yennefer, both of whom had appeared in previous Witcher games. Then there were the minor quests, which included an assortment of mysteries, monster hunts, and errands. As head of the quest department, a role that he'd inherited from his brother, Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz would work with the writers to lay out a basic theme for each quest. This one's about famine, then assign it to a quest designer, who would plot out exactly how that quest would proceed. How many combat encounters would it have? How many cutscenes? How much investigation? This whole logical chain of events would be done to come up with how the situation actually occurs. What are your objectives as a player? What are the challenges you have to face? Said Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz. The pacing is super important, because you can have a great story, but if it has too many dialogues or cutscenes, it can drag. So you need good pacing, and that was a big part of our job in this process. The workload ahead of them was overwhelming, and with plans to ship the game in 2014, their time was limited. By some accounts, The Witcher 3's world would be 30 times the size of The Witcher 2's, and as the quest team started looking at early art assets and plans for the map, they began to panic. The first time they showed us the scope of the world, we were terrified because it was such a huge landmass, said Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz. And since we didn't want filler content, we had to provide some worthwhile content in those regions so they were not empty, because that would be terrible. During these early design sessions, Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz and other designers enacted a simple rule. Don't make boring quests. I called them FedEx quests, the quests that are just fetch quests, said Tomaszkiewicz. Someone says, bring me the cup, or 10 bear skins, or whatever. You bring that stuff to them, and that's it. There's no twist, no nothing. Every quest, no matter how small it should be, should have something memorable in it. Some little twist. Something you might remember it by. Something unexpected happening. At one point in pre-production, worried that they weren't hitting this quality bar, Tomaszkiewicz cut around 50% of the quests they'd sketched out. First of all, because I thought we had no time to actually do all of them in time, and second of all, because I just used this as an opportunity to filter out the weakest ones, he said. They knew the way to make The Witcher 3 stand out was to subvert people's expectations. One early quest called Family Matters would introduce Geralt to the Bloody Baron, a noble with information about Ciri's whereabouts. To find out what the Bloody Baron knew, Geralt would have to help track down his missing wife and daughter. But as the quest continued, you'd find out that the Baron had driven his family to flee by drinking, abusing his wife, and acting like a violent piece of garbage to everyone. Now he appeared to be remorseful and apologetic. Would you forgive him? Try to help him reconcile with his family? Assist him in digging up and exorcising the demonic fetus of a stillborn baby he'd buried in the backyard? The Witcher 3 always took things to the next level. Other RPGs tended to draw strict lines in the sand when it came to morality. BioWare's Mass Effect trilogy, for example, separated your dialogue decisions based on whether they were good or evil. But in The Witcher, there were very few happy endings, which CD Projekt Red saw as a reflection of Polish culture. That's how we Eastern Europeans see things, Marcin Iwinski said in one interview. My grandmother survived the Second World War, She escaped a Nazi transport and they hid in villages for a couple of months. This left an imprint on every single family of a big part of the team. Although the team is very international, the majority are Polish. This leaves something within you. With quests like the Bloody Baron, The Witcher 3's design team wanted to give players tough choices. They wanted to make you question your morality, and they wanted to leave you thinking about those ethical questions long after you finished the game. In the early days, when CD Projekt Red's writers and designers were trying to figure out how to pull off that sort of narrative complexity, they ran into the challenge that oh so many game developers have encountered. How do you determine whether a quest has an impact when you don't even have a game yet? The writer Jakub Szamałek realized he was in trouble one day when he had to take a scene to get reviewed by some of his teammates. He'd written what he thought was a solid script, containing a funny dialogue exchange between hero Geralt and the sorceress Yennefer. Then he'd implemented it into the game's engine to see how the scene looked. The art team hadn't finished Geralt and Yennefer's models, so Szamałek had to use a couple of generic fishermen as placeholders. There was no animation or lip movement in the game yet. In the background, what would eventually become detailed homes were currently big gray boxes. Occasionally, the camera would glitch out and fly into someone's head. There was no voice acting, they weren't going to record dialogue until it was final, so everyone had to read and imagine what the delivery would sound like. And you sit there and you're trying to explain to them, said Szamałek. So listen, imagine that this happens here, and Geralt makes this face, and there's a pause here, and then they say this, and then we show Geralt's face, and he winces. It's supposed to be funny. And we have 10 people in the room, and they're looking on the screen, and they say, I don't get it. Szamałek, a novelist with a wry streak, had never worked on a game before The Witcher 3, so he hadn't realized how difficult writing a video game could be. During one quest, when Geralt and Yennefer would walk together through an abandoned garden on their hunt for Ciri, Szamałek had to write dialogue that captured the character's complicated history. Geralt and Yennefer would snark and tease one another, but there was meant to be an undercurrent of warmth running under their banter. During early testing, it was impossible to convey that sort of subtle human emotion. It all works when you have voice acting in, because a good actor can be both mean and warm at the same time, said Szamałek. But when you just see letters at the bottom of the screen and you have two gray Skellige fishermen talking to each other, it's very difficult to get that and convince whoever's reviewing your work that it's going to work in the end. For Szamałek and the other writers, one solution to this problem was to file draft after draft after draft, iterating on every scene as the rest of the team implemented more and more of the game. Once the game had basic character models and rudimentary animations, it was easier to tell how each scene was doing. People often wondered how CD Projekt Red sharpened the writing in Witcher games so well, especially when there was so much of it. The answer was simple. I don't think there is a single quest in The Witcher 3 which was written once, accepted, and then recorded, Szamałek said. Everything was rewritten dozens of times. In February 2013, CD Projekt Red announced The Witcher 3. Revealing the game through a cover on the popular magazine Game Informer that showed Geralt and Ciri mounted on two horses. Konrad Tomaszkiewicz and his team made lofty promises. The Witcher 3 would be larger than Skyrim. It'd have no loading times. It'd be out in 2014 and feature at least 100 hours of gameplay. We spoke about this cover for the game for a long time, Tomaszkiewicz said. We knew what we needed to expose there was the open world. This was their coming out party. By emphasizing that The Witcher 3 was a game in which you would be able to go anywhere and do anything, CD Projekt Red would show the world that Poland could make pretty good RPGs too. The developers were purposefully ambiguous about the game's platforms, because Sony and Microsoft hadn't yet announced their next consoles, but everyone on The Witcher 3 knew they were putting it out on PC, Xbox One, and PS4, skipping last-generation hardware. This was a big gamble. Some analysts believed that the PS4 and Xbox One wouldn't sell nearly as well as their predecessors, and most publishers were insisting on making their games cross-gen to reach the largest possible audiences, as EA and Activision did with Dragon Age Inquisition and Destiny. CD Projekt Red knew that the older hardware was too limiting for their goals. If they had to restrict The Witcher 3's memory for last-gen consoles, they wouldn't be able to achieve the level of photorealism that they thought they could hit with this game. CD Projekt Red wanted to build a world with a functioning ecosystem and day-night cycle, with elaborate cities and grass that swayed in the wind. They wanted players to be able to explore the entirety of each region without waiting for parts of the game to load. None of this would be possible on the PlayStation 3 or Xbox 360. Not long after announcing the game and showing their demo to Game Informer, CD Projekt Red's engineers made a drastic overhaul to the rendering pipeline that changed the way graphics would appear on screen. The good news was that it made everything look significantly sharper, from the wrinkles on a leather bag to the characters' reflections in water. The bad news was that to make it work, the artists would have to change almost all the models they'd already developed.
"This happens fairly often," said Jose Teixeira, a visual effects artist. "A big feature gets worked on, and if it's deemed important to the game, if the game will really benefit from it, then even if it is a big change and assets have to be redone and whatnot, it's worth doing it." Teixeira, a Portugal native who was primarily responsible for visual effects like weather and blood splatter, I had a very questionable browser history, spent a great deal of time not just creating graphic enhancements, but researching and experimenting with new technology that would make everything look better. He also had to find ways to optimize that technology. A single small village, for example, might have dozens of different light sources, like candles, torches, and campfires, all sucking away at The Witcher 3's memory budget every time they flickered. "We had to work a lot with what we call levels of details," Teixeira said. "The further away things are, the less detailed they are. So we had to work very carefully to make sure that we're not, for example, using a really ridiculously complex particle system that's being spawned a mile away." As development proceeded, The Witcher 3's designers again began to panic that they didn't have enough content. They promised the world that this game would take at least 100 hours to play. It might have been a ridiculous number, but it was the one they'd promised, and they felt compelled to hit it. "We had this feeling that the game might be too short, that we might not deliver on 100 hours, said Matthias Tomaszkiewicz. And we were like, "No, we told everyone we have to do it, we have to deliver 100 hours. Tomaszkiewicz and his department kept churning out quests, trying their hardest to follow the edict that none should feel too FedEx-like, but the fear of emptiness lingered. One fundamental conceit of The Witcher 3 was that Geralt would be able to own and ride a horse, which he called Roach. A running joke in The Witcher book series was that Geralt gave all his horses the same name. Horseback riding was not only significantly faster than walking, it was the main method of moving through The Witcher 3's various regions. As a result, every area of the game needed to be big. Really, really big. Every day the game's world would get bigger, requiring more and more content from the quest department. "We knew we wanted an open world, and we knew we wanted to have horse travel. We wanted to have a very big, realistic scope," said Matthias Tomaszkiewicz, "and this basically caused the locations to grow and grow." The most significant issue, and the cause of the most anxiety for the quest department, was how many of The Witcher 3's core mechanics remained unfinished. Combat wasn't entirely complete yet, so the designers had to put Geralt into God mode during their testing, which meant he'd defeat every monster in one hit. This made it tough to judge whether quests were paced properly. It's hard to estimate precisely how many hours of gameplay you will have when you don't actually have the gameplay balancing and mechanics in place yet, said Tomaszkiewicz. All these unknowns added up to a game that nobody knew how to properly judge. As Matthias Tomaszkiewicz put it, it's super hard to do quality reviews when you can't see the quality. And throughout 2013 and even into 2014, as CD Projekt Red sat through reviews and tested out various parts of the game, they remained nervous that The Witcher 3's world felt too empty. They had pulled off some incredible technical accomplishments thanks to the new graphics renderer, and it was common for members of the team to gather around and gawk at how pretty everything looked. The foliage looked like it had come right out of a Polish forest. Geralt's ringmail was so elaborately detailed you could identify each ring of metal. The leather looked sufficiently leathery. But the world was enormous, and the whole team grew anxious that they wouldn't be able to live up to that nagging promise of 100 hours. Each of CD Projekt Red's major regions was bigger than most open-world games, and The Witcher 3 had three of them, plus smaller areas like the Keep of Kaer Morhen and the prologue area, White Orchard. To flesh out this world, a team of level designers combed the map and placed landmarks that they called points of interest, POIs, throughout each area. Each of these POIs would hold an activity ranging from minor, a group of marauding bandits, to major, a merchant wants you to find out who killed his assistant. Some POIs led to dumpy villages, others took you to ancient ruins filled with monsters and treasure. The level design team was responsible for ensuring there were enough POIs to fill up the entire world. "We wanted to get an idea of the scope first. How many POIs feels good, how much is too much," said Miles Tost, a level designer. "We just place them on the level. And then we would take the barely functioning horse and ride in between them and actually measure the time it would take. And then we would go, all right, so every minute we have a POI or whatever." We would even reference other games like Red Dead Redemption or Skyrim, check how they did it, and then we wanted to figure out, all right, does this feel good for us? Do we need it denser or vary from that? Tusk's team didn't just want The Witcher 3's world to feel like a collection of disparate quests. They wanted it to support an entire ecosystem. There would be a village that built bricks connected to the city of Novigrad via elaborate trade routes. There would be manufacturing, agriculture, and all the other accoutrements of a realistic medieval world. If you look at the farming areas around Novigrad, all of these exist to support this huge city which believably could exist in this world, said Tost. All of these people living there, they get support from different kinds of infrastructure around the world. This was something we put a really big focus on creating. There's even a village where they make carts. As The Witcher 3 staff grew larger, this insistence on realism led to some complications. At one point, Tusk's team noticed a serious problem in Velen. There was too much to eat. Velen was always supposed to be this famine-ridden land, said Tusk, where people don't really have a lot of food. For some reason, though, an environment artist had stocked up many of Velen's homes, filling the cabinets with sausages and vegetables. It bothered the level designers too much to leave as it was, so they spent hours digging through every village in Velen, taking food away from the people like twisted reverse Robin Hoods. We had to go through all the houses in this area and make sure there was barely any food, Tost said. It was this kind of attention to detail that CD Projekt Red thought could elevate The Witcher 3 above the competition, not unlike Naughty Dog's approach on Uncharted 4. Most players might not have noticed the amount of food in a Velen cupboard, but those who paid attention would be rewarded. There was something special about realizing that the developers of a game actually took the time to make it so tree branches rustled and crackled when it was windy, and so the sun would rise earlier and earlier the farther north you went. Of course, one of the problems with being a studio full of perfectionists is that you spend too much time on the little things. From a player's point of view, you could almost never have enough detail, said Tost. People like to explore a lot, and you can totally understand that. But of course, at some point, you have to consider the scope of the project and whether this rock angled in a certain way actually adds something to the world. Or maybe you should instead go and fix another two bugs somewhere. Every second spent adding an extra detail to the game, every minute spent fine-tuning quests, and every hour spent wrangling with the unfinished world led to the schedule progressing faster than CD Projekt Red would have liked it to. All those days added up, and as they entered 2014, the studio realized that they needed more development time. In March 2014, CD Projekt Red announced that they were delaying The Witcher 3 an extra half year to February 2015. The board was really stressed, but they don't come in and try to influence the game itself because they trust us, said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz, the director. It was really hard for me because I got on my shoulders all of this stress, this baggage. I knew that it could be catastrophic because we put a lot of money into this game, and it needs to be a success. Since Marcin Iwiński had founded CD Projekt in 1994 and CD Projekt Red in 2002, they'd made a total of just two games. The Witcher 3 would be the third. The company was able to stay independent thanks to investors and other sources of revenue, like GOG, CD Projekt Red's successful online store, and Marcin Iwiński wasn't concerned that they'd go bankrupt if The Witcher 3 flopped, but this was still a huge gamble for them. Thanks to the Game Informer cover and several big trailers, The Witcher 3 was getting more buzz than either of its predecessors, and failing to live up to fans' expectations might be a death blow for CD Projekt Red's hopes of competing with other big publishers. This hype was really cool, said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. At the same time, when we were in the heart of the project, we got a lot of problems, like the engine would crash all the time and we didn't get streaming on time. On the PS4 and Xbox, we could render one dot on the screen, and we knew that we needed to deliver, so it created this huge stress on the whole team. What this meant was that 2014 would be a year full of crunch for the Polish company. It helped that at CD Projekt Red, unlike at most companies in North America, overtime was paid. Polish labor laws required it. At E3 in June, CD Projekt Red planned to show a lengthy Witcher 3 demo that featured Geralt exploring the swamps of Velen. During those long nights and weekends, when the crunch seemed like it would never end, what helped drive the development team was the fact that they'd be on the E3 stage alongside multi-billion dollar publishers like Ubisoft and Activision. Among the neon spectacle of the E3 show floor, where massive games like Madden and Assassin's Creed dominated everybody's attention, The Witcher 3 held its own, winning E3 awards from major websites like IGN and GameSpot. CD Projekt Red were the underdogs, the outsiders, the guys from Poland who had made only two other games, yet fans thought The Witcher 3 was one of the most impressive things at the show. "It's a source of motivation for us," said Piotr Tomsinski, an animation programmer. "We would like to be like the super famous companies."